Okay. Good morning and welcome to the Narkee Street Shabbat Morning Bible Study. This is the third week that we've been looking at the wisdom tradition from the Bible. And this morning I have a handout. Well, Sheila's been here, but the rest of you haven't. So this is kind of the summation of the last 3 weeks. So it's your lucky day. And, okay, so first off, we start off looking at what is wisdom from the ancient Near East view, and then from the biblical view. And if you want to turn real quick, Proverbs chapter 1, we'll go through a few of these examples. Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. And compare that with Proverbs 15. Here's a handout. Proverbs 15, verse 33. The fear of the Lord teaches a man wisdom, and humility comes before honor. Notice in both cases, it talks about the fear of the Lord, both examples we just used. In one case, it says it's the beginning of knowledge, and the other one talks about it being wisdom. And if you read through Proverbs or any wisdom literature, you'll see that wisdom is knowledge. It's knowing something specific. In the ancient Near East, it's knowing the way the world works, seeing patterns behind the exterior world and learning from them. And we'll go over those a few real quick. But in the biblical tradition, wisdom comes to be also connected to the fear of the Lord or the fear of God. As we just read in 1 verse 7, and then we also read in 15:33, you could look at Job 28:28, that example there. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. It's Job 28:28, and then you might as well read an example from Ecclesiastes. It's the end of Ecclesiastes, the last chapter, chapter 12. The writer decides to sum up, okay, everything I've been talking about is very hard to understand, and it's kind of written like in a postmodern way, the book of Ecclesiastes. A lot of questions and doubts. But what does he do to summarize it? Chapter 12, verse 13. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So the fear of the Lord is a core part of the biblical wisdom tradition. That is wisdom. That is knowledge. And today, I mean, evangelical Christians talk about knowing God, having a relationship with God. You can really maybe even see there's some roots here of that, going back to this idea. The next category in the handout, wisdom and knowledge. What is it in the ancient world, and how does it appear in the Bible? First off, it's something that's fixed or static, something that's been established since before creation, like I was saying, something that is there. I almost see it as, I could almost say they're like scientists, first scientists. They're looking for gravity and the different laws of physics of, you know, the sun goes up, the sun comes down, there's the moon, the stars rotate around, or the earth goes around, and you see the stars in the sky at different times of the year. But if you look at, like, say, Proverbs 3, it's all a part of the creation wisdom. Proverbs 3:19, By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding he set the heavens in place. Verse 20. By his knowledge the deeps were divided and the clouds let drop the dew. Then go to chapter 8, which is the most famous chapter of Proverbs when it is connecting to creation and wisdom. And people especially like this chapter when they look at John chapter 1, talking about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and all of that. Proverbs 8:22, the Lord brought me forth as the first of his works, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began, when there were no oceans, I was given birth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, and so on. Wisdom is there. Verse 30, I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence. Wisdom is there. It's part of God's creation, even part of creating, even looking at how you read it. And so that's the one characteristic of wisdom. The next one is it's hidden. Too wonderful to grasp. It's beyond knowing in some ways. Job 42, verse 3. Job 42:3. You ask, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. Okay, this is Job talking to God. You know, remember, we'll look at a couple examples when the Lord finally appears to Job. God basically lays out three chapters of, did you do this? Did you do this? Do you understand how this works? Do you understand how this works? This is kind of a classic list of wisdom or knowledge that you would know if you're part of this category of being in the wisdom tradition. And Job says, no, I don't know that. I can't know that. It's too wonderful for me to know. Psalm 139, verse 6. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Ecclesiastes, again the same thing. It's beyond me, this knowledge, which is talking about wisdom. 7:23. All this I tested by wisdom. Ecclesiastes 7:23. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I am determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. Whatever wisdom may be, it is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate, and to search out wisdom in the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. So here's the other part of the story. On one hand, it's hidden. It's too wonderful to grasp. Some people would say it's even impossible to understand. But that is the goal of the wisdom culture, the wisdom tradition, is to seek it out and to find it and to understand it. And that's what the author here in Ecclesiastes is saying. Even though it's way out there, I went for it. I went to search it. I went to search for it. And so that's the next category there under hidden. You know, you've got to seek it. You've got to go after it. Let's see. If we look at, let's turn back to Job 28. Job 28, verse 12. In a way, that's kind of the great reward of wisdom is the whole search for it. It's more of the journey rather than when you actually get there. That's part of gaining wisdom. Job 28, verse 12. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me. The sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir. And it goes through all of these different types of valuable rocks. Verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing. It's concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, verse 28, and he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. So, again, it's this thing of, it's hidden, it's hard to find, it's out there, but ultimately it's with the Lord. The fear of the Lord specifically. And let's look at one more example, Proverbs 2, which follows the same reasoning, line of thought. Proverbs 2, verse 3. This whole chapter of Proverbs is about wisdom. Really, the first 9 chapters of Proverbs are about the personification of wisdom. And on one hand, she's a woman who builds a house, and it's describing why people want her and why they need her. Proverbs 2, verse 3, and if you call out for insight, and if you cry aloud for understanding, and if you look for it as for silver, and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord, and you will find the knowledge of God. Kind of, you hear an echo there of Job with the whole silver and gold business. Also in chapter 3, verse 13, blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she is more profitable than silver, yields better returns than gold. She is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her. What's that? There's a praise and worship song. Nothing you desire compares. Yeah. So that's the second part of wisdom. The third part is, again, about these patterns or these rules that govern the world and govern relationships. And one part is the natural world, and that's looking at how things function. Probably the best example is Job chapter 38 to 41. Those chapters I alluded to or brought up before. The Lord appears to Job in the whirlwind, at Seahah in Hebrew, and he starts to ask, who is this that darkens my counsel? The Lord speaking to Job. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Who marked off its dimensions? Who stretched the measuring line? Verse 12, have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? Verse 19, what is the way to the abode of light? Where does darkness reside? Verse 22, have you entered the storehouses of snow? Chapter 39, verse 1, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? And chapter 41, can you pull in the Leviathan with a fish hook? Or tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? And so there's all of these different types of animals, natural events, and it's all part of this tradition within the natural world. And this especially goes among human relationships, which I think is all pretty well known among us about the righteous and the wicked. We've heard it quite often throughout Proverbs, if you've ever read Proverbs any. It's just go to Proverbs 10. The whole chapter there is a dichotomy between, on one hand, there's this, the righteous. On the other hand, there's this, is the wicked. Proverbs 10, verse 1. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. Ill-gotten treasures are of no value, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but thwarts the craving of the wicked. Lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. Verse 6, blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. Verse 7, the memory of the righteous will be a blessing, but the name of the wicked will rot. The wise in heart accepts commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. So it's a very simple view of the world. There's the righteous, there's the wicked. And it doesn't really address the rest of us who are kind of in between, which is kind of what Ecclesiastes does. It says, look, I've seen the righteous prosper and people who do wrong things not be punished in this life. And the righteous actually suffer, you know, be persecuted or because they did the right thing. And so these are questions that are being developed throughout this whole tradition of, okay, yes, there's the righteous, yes, there's the wicked, but what about people who are in between, which would probably be maybe we'd say the most of the world, kind of in that gray area. Some of us are more righteous, some of us might be more wicked, but it's the world's more nuanced than that. And finally, to finish off this section of wisdom tradition, an important thing for us to remember is, on one hand, there's wisdom, and on the other hand, there's folly, which, you know, we've read a lot in our time, because it's so much a part of our civilization, this wisdom and folly, or foolishness. And if wisdom is knowledge, and it's knowing what to do and doing it, folly is the opposite of that. It's knowing what to do and not doing it. It's not someone who's naive or stupid or young and inexperienced. Sometimes we kind of put those words together. It's actually rejecting what you should do. And let's look at a couple examples real quick. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Right? So, again, the dichotomy. Fear the Lord is taking that wisdom, but the fools despise it. They reject it. Verse 22. How long will you simple ones love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery and fools hate knowledge? Again, being foolish is hating or rejecting the knowledge, the wisdom. Verse 29. Since they hated knowledge and they did not choose to fear the Lord. So if you reject the knowledge, you do not fear the Lord, you do not have wisdom, and you are a fool, according to the Bible. And I think in Psalms it says somewhere about the fool says there is no God. So it all goes together. There's other examples there. Last week, we went into the wisdom tradition in Deuteronomy. There's the next section there on the handout. We compared Exodus 18, Numbers 11, and Deuteronomy chapter 1. And they all three of those passages had to do with why were the leaders chosen for Israel. Remember in Exodus chapter 18, we have Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, coming to him and saying, look, you can't do this. This is crazy. It's too much work. You're losing your mind. And so they set up a system of judges or people below Moses to handle court cases with the people if there's problems. And I've put there in the, what do you call those things, parentheses, the character,
brackets.
The brackets, okay, parentheses are, no,
parentheses are.
Yeah, no, okay, well, those are parentheses, okay, it's probably two different, yeah, countries here. Exodus 18:21, capability, integrity, and fear of God. Those are the characteristics that are given there about what a leader will have, what's the required characteristics. Numbers 11 basically says it's someone who has the Spirit. God's Spirit has been put upon them. That's how it's given. Deuteronomy 1, you remember Deuteronomy is a retelling of what's happened in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. And it's when Moses is looking over before the people go into the land before he dies. And it's a rewriting of the history that's gone on with their travels in the wilderness. And here, let's go to Deuteronomy real quick, chapter 1, because this is important. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 13. Verse 12. How can I bear your problems and your burdens and your disputes all by myself? Choose some wise, understanding, and respected men from each of your tribes, and I will set them over you. Here, the characteristics are like what you hear straight out of Proverbs. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Proverbs 8. If you go to Proverbs chapter 8. And for those who are studying at the university, you can go read Moshe Weinfeld's book on the Deuteronomistic school. The Deuteronomic school. Proverbs 8:15. By me kings reign, and rulers make laws that are just. By me princes govern, and all nobles rule on the earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me. Again, this is talking about wisdom. Verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. To fear the Lord is to hate evil. So, it's Deuteronomy, as we'll see, has strong connections with wisdom tradition. And we'll look at a few of those examples. We have another parallel between Deuteronomy and Exodus. If you look at Exodus chapter 23, verse 8, it says, do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of those who see, and it twists the words of the righteous. And actually, let me just read it in context. Verse 6, Exodus 23, verse 6, do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the righteous. Do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be aliens, because you were aliens in Egypt. Okay, keep your finger there. Let's look at this, the parallel in Deuteronomy 16. Start in verse 18, Deuteronomy 16, 18. Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for the bribe blinds the eyes of the wise. According to Deuteronomy, who are the wise? That we just read in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy. Who are they? Deuteronomy 1:13. They're the what?
The appointed people.
Yeah, right, the leaders. It's specifically one of their characteristics. They are going to be this. And so it says here in Deuteronomy 16:19, for the bribe blinds the eyes of the wise. In other words, of the judges. I mean, it's obvious to see that in the context, too, of this is a dealing with justice and judgment. So, but Deuteronomy makes it very clear. The wise are the ones that are making the decisions. Verse 20, follow justice and justice alone. Really, you could say pursue justice. It's Rodef. It's the same thing where, you know, pursue peace. From Psalms, it's that same verb there. But pursue, follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land of the Lord your God is giving you. And let's look at Deuteronomy 4 real quick. Deuteronomy 4, verse 6. Here's another example in Deuteronomy of wisdom. Observe them carefully, for this will show your... Again, what is Deuteronomy banging home? What's the whole purpose of the book of Deuteronomy? How would you summarize it?
Maybe it's a retelling?
Yeah, it's a retelling of what, though? What's the most important thing for the people to do?
Laws.
Obey.
The laws, right. The commandments. The mitzvot. Actually, there's like four or five words used for that. You know, Torah, teaching, the ordinances. Well, let's see what it says. Deuteronomy 4:1. Hear now, O Israel, the decrees and laws I am about to teach you. Follow them so that you may live and may go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God, your father, is giving you. Do not add to what I command you, and do not subtract from it, but keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. You saw with your own eyes what the Lord did at Baal Peor. The Lord your God destroyed from among you everyone who followed the Baal of Peor. But all of you who held fast the Lord your God are still alive today. See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom. It will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. You know, we hear this the same thing in the wisdom tradition. Wisdom, the wise, understanding. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? In Proverbs, in Job, in Ecclesiastes, those are your three wisdom books in the Bible. Do they ever talk about Moses or Egypt or Abraham or David? Or do they talk about any of the historical narrative? Do they talk about any of this type of stuff? They don't. And
they don't talk about the individuals.
Right. Or the great story of the nation. Of, you know, God did this, God did that. They don't talk about that. Because wisdom, again, is focused on the world, the physical world. It's on nature, if you want to call it. That's kind of wisdom's original context that's coming out of. Deuteronomy, though, we start to see wisdom is incorporating this idea of that there are patterns and rules out there in the world, and bringing them closer to God's commandments, to God's word, or whatever you want to call it. Deuteronomy saying, look, it's here, it's in the commandments, it's in the teachings that the Lord's given us from Sinai. And so what are some of these parallels here? If you look on the sheet between Deuteronomy and wisdom tradition, you have fear of God. Deuteronomy 4:10. Remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, when he said to me, assemble the people before me to hear my words, so that they may learn to revere me as long as they live in the land, and may teach them to their children. Okay, revere me is fear. To fear me. 5:26. Maybe. Actually, go to 6:2. 6:1, these are the commands, decrees, laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land. Verse 2, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all of his decrees and commands. What was Proverbs' definition of fear? Fear of the Lord or fear of God? What's the parallel in Proverbs we read in chapter Proverbs 1:7? It's wisdom. And what did Deuteronomy say its leaders would have? They would have wisdom. They would be wise. And Deuteronomy's being specific here, it's the commands that God has given at Horeb, at Sinai. That is that's the fear of the Lord, the fear of God. So you can look at those examples later on. So the next one, keep the commandments and live. Again, you keep the commandments and you will live. That's all over Deuteronomy. We just read that in chapter 4. Deuteronomy ends like that, chapter 30. Chapter 30, verse 16. This verse probably sums up the whole book of Deuteronomy. the best. Deuteronomy 30, verse 16. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. Verse 19, this day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life so that you and your children may live and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice. And how does somebody choose death according to Deuteronomy?
Choose death.
How do you choose death? What do you do?
No, don't.
Yeah. And Proverbs chapter 4, what's Proverbs chapter 4 say about all this? Very similar. 4:4. Proverbs 4:4. Lay hold of my words with all your heart. Keep my commands and you will live. That's 4:4:7:2. Keep my commands and you will live. Guard my teachings as the apple of your eye. And let's keep reading there in Proverbs 7, verse 3. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. And then go to Proverbs 6, verse 20. My son, keep your father's commands. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them upon your heart forever. Fasten them around your neck. When you walk, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will speak to you. What's that remind us of in Deuteronomy?
Shema.
Shema, right? That's the whole core of of Judaism today. You know, it's the creed, monotheism, and wisdom tradition. Here in Deuteronomy, come right together. The other example there is, if you do the commands, if you love the Lord your God. By the way, love the Lord your God, and in Hebrew, love has this idea of obey. Often we think of love as kind of an emotional, romantic thing, which I know most of us know it's not. Obviously, there's some aspects of that in reality, but especially in Deuteronomy, love is this covenantal type of language that you find in other ancient Near East writings that has to do with obedience. So, again, love the Lord your God is this idea of obeying. Loving is obeying. It's doing. All right.
And submission.
And what?
And submission.
Submission, right. Yeah.
Can't have those
rebellious
kings.
Yeah. Shaking them. Yeah, exactly. So we read from Deuteronomy 4:2 about don't take anything away from my teaching. Moses said that. Deuteronomy 4:2. Same thing in Proverbs 6. Sorry, Proverbs 30. Proverbs 30, verse 5. Every word of God is flawless. He is a shield to those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words, or he will rebuke you and prove you a liar. And we see other examples of that in wisdom tradition. And where does this eventually end up in the New Testament? Where is this verse applied?
Sounds like Matthew 5. Like right before the Sermon on the Mount.
Jesus says nothing will
fall away.
But what about the part about adding to?
Revelation.
Yeah, Revelation. It's at the very last chapter where it says don't add or take away. And so, you know, this whole idea goes all the way to the end of our canon. We've got making vows to God, honoring parents. Those also are a part of Deuteronomy. Let's turn to the next page. There's a lot here. I made this handout because of Keith Leister, so you can thank him after the Bible study. Justice is a huge issue in Deuteronomy. It's very, very important. Let's go to Deuteronomy. We'll look at just a couple of these examples. Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19:14. Do not move your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive from the land your Lord your God has given you to possess. Deuteronomy 27:17. Cursed is the man who moves his neighbor's boundary stone. Now in Proverbs, this same, you can keep your finger in Deuteronomy and put another finger in Proverbs. In Proverbs 22, verse 28, do not move an ancient boundary stone set up by your forefathers. Okay, it's there. And then in chapter 23, verse 10, do not move an ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless. Here you have the orphans connected to who this person would be. So it would be someone in the society who's defenseless, because they wouldn't have the clout or the status to maybe fight against some corporation that could come in and have the big lawyers and do what they want to do. Fault waits. So keep one finger in Proverbs. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 25, verse 13. Do not have two different weights in your bag, one heavy, one light. Do not have two different measures in your house, one large, one small. You must have accurate and honest weights and measures so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. Then go to Proverbs 11, verse 1. The Lord abhors dishonest scales, but accurate weights are his delight. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 23. The Lord detests differing weights, and dishonest scales do not please him. And also verse 10. Differing weights and differing measures, the Lord detests them both.
No. No.
Partiality and judgment, the next one. Proverbs 24:23. To show partiality and judgment is not good. Proverbs 28, verse 21. To show partiality is not good, yet a man will do wrong for a piece of bread. This phrase, to show partiality and judgment, only appears two times here in Proverbs, and only appears two times in Deuteronomy. Those are the only places it appears.
Just show me where you are. Okay.
So, again, this is a unique connection between the two books, Deuteronomy and Proverbs, of the wisdom.
There's another one, Deuteronomy, in chapter 25, verse 15. It says you shouldn't have a stone in a stone.
No, I'm not talking about false weights. Partiality and judgment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. False weights.
We just did
it.
The false weights, yeah.
See it.
The fourth bubble there, I mentioned pursuing justice. And justice is a huge part of Deuteronomy. When you look at the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments appear in two places. Where are they?
Exodus 20.
Exodus 20.
Deuteronomy 5.
And Deuteronomy 5. They have a few differences between them, not really that many, but there's one major difference, and it's found in why do we keep the Sabbath, the Shabbat. What does Exodus say the reason we should keep the Shabbat, and what does Deuteronomy say is the reason we should keep the Shabbat? This is down there, under kindness to slaves. Yeah, Exodus 20 says, because God created in 7 days and created in 6 days, he rested on the seventh day, is Exodus 20's reasoning. Deuteronomy 5's reasoning, let's look at it real quick. Deuteronomy 5, verse 14. Deuteronomy 5:14. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son nor your daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your ox. And by the way, it says your manservant or maidservant, it means slaves. Neither your slaves, nor your ox, nor your donkey. And so on. Because, verse 15, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Since Pesach, Passover, is coming up in a week, this is a good reminder of, because this is a part of this teaching is part of a lot that goes on in the Haggadah.
Did it translate verse 15 as slave?
No, manservant. This is NIV.
So remember that you were a manservant in Egypt?
I know it's...
Is that what it says?
Yeah, that's what it says. Huh. But anyways, it's slave.
Sure, I mean,
and
either one.
So this phrase, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, will appear 3, 4, 5, 6 times in Deuteronomy when it says you need to remember the orphan, the widow, the alien, or the poor. Let's maybe look at a couple of those examples. Deuteronomy 14:28. Actually, you look at 15. 15 verse 12. This is an Israelite who sells himself to be like an indentured servant, and they serve 6 years, and then they're supposed to be let go on the seventh year. And you're supposed to give him or her, when they leave, money or whatever. And the reasoning, verse 15, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. 16, look at Deuteronomy 16, verse 11. It talks about celebrating Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. And you're supposed to bring out your slaves and along with your sons and your daughters. And you're supposed to bring out the aliens, the orphans, the widows living among you, and you're all supposed to celebrate together, eat together, right? Verse 12, why? Because remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Follow carefully these decrees. Deuteronomy has this theology of the orphans, the widows, and the aliens, or the strangers, or you might want to say the immigrants today in our context. They're a crucial part of the society, and you're not supposed to ignore them or to not include them in what's going on. And it ultimately comes down to the reasoning that you were once in their position, so you should realize why it's wrong to do that. And it's not acceptable according to the Lord. One more example of Proverbs is... I think it was back to 14 again. Proverbs 14. Sorry. Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 14. Verse 28. At the end of every 3 years, bring all the tithes of that year's produce and store it in the towns, so that the Levites, who have no allotment or inheritance of their own, and the aliens, and the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied. And again, these will appear in Deuteronomy, the orphan, the widow, the alien, the poor. And you're supposed to take care of them. And this is a big part of wisdom tradition. If you go, let's look at a couple examples. Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15:25. The Lord tears down the proud man's house, but he keeps the widow's boundaries intact. Proverbs 23, verse 10. We read this one before, do not move an ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the orphans, for their defender is strong and he will take up their case against you. Proverbs 19:17. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will reward him for what he has done. Job Turn to Job chapter 6. I mean, that's an example, but maybe I'll look for a stronger one here. Job chapter 22. His friend Eliphaz they're talking about, in their tradition, it's important that, verse 7, you gave no water to the weary and you withheld food from the hungry, though you were a powerful man owning land and an honored man living on it, and you sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. He's talking about the wicked here. Later on, Job is going to answer him, and I think it's in chapter 29, and Job says, look, this is what I did. Job 29, verse 7, when I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, young men saw me and stepped aside, the old men rose to their feet. Go down to verse 12. Why is everybody giving Job respect? He says this is the reason. Verse 12. Because I rescued the poor who cried for help, the orphans who had none to assist him. The man who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing, and justice was my robe and turban. The phrase righteousness and justice is a big part of the Old Testament language, and it particularly has an idea dealing with justice to the poor or to those who fall between the cracks in society. So whenever you see a verse that has righteousness and justice appear, it 90+% of the time it's going to deal with something to deal with social justice. I put on righteousness as my clothing, justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind, I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger, the alien. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth. So the bottom line is caring for the orphan, the widow, the alien, the poor, is slaves. I mean, you can just list it all in there. People with disabilities, anybody who falls in the cracks of a society, that's a big part of the biblical wisdom tradition and in particular Deuteronomy. Now, we come to today, Jesus' wisdom tradition, which we're not going to be able to do, really. We're going to just glance at it, and it would really take a few more weeks to do, because it's a huge thing. But there is, I would say, a very strong connection between Jesus and what we've been looking at the last 2 weeks. First off, the whole idea of love, which, you know, when Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? And we have two versions. One, Jesus answers, he says, right, what's the greatest commandment?
Love the Lord your God.
Which is what?
Deuteronomy 6:4-9.
The Shema, right? And then the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, which is coming from Leviticus. There's this, we'll see that Jesus also uses the book of Deuteronomy a lot in when he's quoting things. When you think of the temptation that was Satan in the desert, the three tests that he's given, how does Jesus respond each time? From what book does he quote to Satan?
Deuteronomy.
They're all Deuteronomy.
They're all from Deuteronomy. And they mainly, two are from chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, which is where the Shema is. And as you know, in Jewish culture, tradition, practice, if you quote something from within a section of a book, you actually could be alluding to the verses around it as well. So there's always got to be the shadow of the Shema in the background of, I would say, with the temptation with Satan. I mean, and that's your ultimate answer to Satan is love. I love
one
the Lord.
From chapter 8?
Yeah, one's from 8. One's two from 6 and one's from 8.
Man shall not live by bread alone.
Yeah. bread alone is from chapter 8. So every time you hear Satan ask these questions, Jesus, you have to think, you have to see the shadow of the Shema somewhere in the background, that all of this ultimately comes down to love the Lord your God with all your heart, completely sold out to God. The second greatest commandment is the neighbor. And often people talk about the neighbor as that Jesus, this is a revolutionary idea from Jesus, and we know that it's really just a part of his culture at that time. There's different examples that we don't have to bring up here today, time-wise, but it's a part of Jesus' worldview that he definitely advocates. And it's also part of wisdom tradition. If you go to Proverbs 14, Proverbs 14:21, he who despises his neighbor sins, but blessed is he who is kind to the needy. You remember, we'll come to it. Proverbs 16:29. A violent man entices his neighbor and leads him down a path that is not good. Do not testify against your neighbor without cause, or use your lips to deceive. Do not say, I'll do to him as he has done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did. Verse 10. Do not forsake your friend and the friend of your father. Do not go to your brother's house when disaster strikes you. Better a neighbor nearby than a brother far away. Proverbs 29:5. Whoever flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his feet. Ecclesiastes 4:4. And I saw that all labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless. There's this big question, I'd say, in the time of Jesus, you know, who is my neighbor? We think of the story of the Good Samaritan, right? The guy comes up to Jesus and says, well, who's my neighbor? We all know, love my neighbor as myself, so who is it? There's obviously different interpretations going around. And as we can see from what we've just read here in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you need to have a good relationship with whoever this neighbor is. You shouldn't take advantage of or compromise that relationship. And
you could mention there were also competing views. Like Qumran, part of loving your neighbor meant hating your enemy.
Right.
So like you love the in people and you hate, meaning you separate yourself from the out people. So Jesus is clearly not part of that camp. You know, he's contrasting to that people who would interpret it that way.
Yeah.
Like he's giving the maximal interpretation of neighbors. Basically, everyone you come in contact with is your neighbor.
Well, let's take that and apply it one step further. Jesus says, second greatest command is love your neighbor as yourself. And what does he say in Matthew chapter 6? Matthew chapter 5, verse 43. You heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Right? You think of the parable of the Good Samaritan. The guy says, well, Jesus, who is my neighbor? Basically, he's saying, the Samaritan is who for the Jew at that time?
Neighbor.
Enemy.
Oh, yeah.
Or both.
Both, yeah.
Like, they...
Neighboring enemy.
They conflate. They come together. They overlap. And isn't that true in life? Often, often some of the most difficult people to deal with are Christians, unfortunately, who technically would fit more into the neighbor category when you think of it in the structure of the Bible. Or family members, people you live with, are literally your neighbors, and sometimes you can have issues with getting along with each other. Let's look back at Proverbs 24, talking about the whole enemy thing. Proverbs, as we close up here, Proverbs 24, verse 17. Do not gloat when your enemy falls. When he stumbles, do not let your heart rejoice. For the Lord will see and disapprove and turn his wrath away from him. So it's interesting. Here, it's very similar to Jesus. When your enemy falls, don't rejoice over it. Don't be happy. Chapter 25, verse 21. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. And I've heard differing ideas about what that is. I don't know if, Randy, you want to throw in anything here. Somebody said that putting the coals on the head is a way of kind of shaming him into doing the right thing. It's not necessarily a negative thing or something. I don't know.
I'd rather not repeat it because I don't know it myself.
Okay.
It's different than that.
Right. There's a couple different things. But
it's a blessing to give people burning coal.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a negative thing. I've heard, yeah. But
I don't know that of my knowledge.
Paul quotes this, right, in Romans, the book of Romans, he quotes this specific verse about if you treat the person right, even though they're doing you wrong, you put burning coals on their heads. And so we basically are going to have to end here now because we've run out of time. There's a lot more here to be done. And the section I gave you of the Sermon on the Mount is really probably the strongest section that connects Jesus with the wisdom tradition. And if we follow, maybe I'll just conclude with this. If we follow the idea that we looked at from the beginning about what is wisdom, the definition?
Fear the Lord.
Fear the Lord, knowledge. It's this idea, this understanding. As we move into the Second Temple period, the wisdom tradition is evolving. It's morphing into something a little different. Whereas before, the sages, the Chachamim, were looking out the window and looking at nature and seeing, where God is out there. As we move into the time of Jesus, starting with Ben Sira and the wisdom of Solomon, the sages start to now look into the Bible, because at this time the canon is being closed, and they're starting to say, okay, this is God's word, and let's see God in here. And so instead of looking for how the locust has, I don't know how many wings a locust has, but grasshopper, and figuring out these like interesting things about how God is behind all of that, they're now taking apart the text word by word and starting to find hidden meaning behind it, like you would find in hidden wisdom out in nature. And that's when you start to develop this tradition of Midrash and exegesis, Jewish exegesis, that you start getting into the funky interpretational things that you find at Qumran, and later you'll see in rabbinic literature. And so this idea of interpretation is teaching. And that's what the core of Matthew 5 is. Jesus will talk about, you've heard that it said, don't commit adultery. You've heard that it says, don't commit murder. I say this. And basically Jesus is saying, here's my interpretation of it. You've heard that it's the same thing with the Good Samaritan. You know, who's my neighbor? You've heard that it said, love your neighbor as yourself. Who's my neighbor? This is what I say it is. This is my teaching of it. And if you let's just end in Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. This is kind of my final main point. Matthew 7, verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, and by the way, this is the end of the Sermon on the Mount. This is kind of maybe what we call the summary of it. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, puts them into practice, is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. What did we say the difference between a wise man and a fool was, according to wisdom tradition?
The wise man does what he knows is right, and the fool rejects what he knows is right.
Right. And so here it is. The wise man puts it into practice, builds his house on the rock. And we have the same idea of wisdom, chokhmah, how she built her house, right? In chapter 9, 25, the rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man. So here we are, fool, folly. Who built his house on sand. Verse 27. The rain came down and streams rose. The winds blew and beat against them. And it fell with a great crash. So this is kind of where I see it leading to. This idea of these teachings of Jesus following in the vein of wisdom tradition. And just like the sages in the time of the Bible would make disciples, children, students go on and pass up from generation to generation, so too Jesus is doing that. And that's how he kind of ends his whole ministry on earth, right? Matthew chapter 28, the Great Commission. Go and make disciples. And verse 20, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. That's the greatest gift a rabbi, a master, a teacher can pass on to their students, is having them obey to follow through. And that's wisdom. Shabbat shalom.